Rebag is a luxury resale marketplace. They have a curated collection of investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry. Each piece is carefully vetted and verified by experts. You can buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Hermès, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. That's Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10.
Betches Media presents...
He's in the building!
Afternoon Tea with host Sammy Sage.
Is that what you're saying?
Please proceed, Governor.
Presented by the Betches Sup Podcast.
Better hope there's a lot of girls listening to this with the volume turned down.
Your weekly dose of political therapy.
Cardi, that's what I've been doing my whole life.
And now, with this week's guest...
Well, there were three of us in this marriage, so it was a bit crowded.
Your host, Sammy Sage. Welcome to today's episode of Afternoon Tea, your companion to the morning announcements and weekly political therapy session brought to you by The Betches Sup. Today's guest is Malcolm Gladwell. Ever heard of him? He's here to tell us about his new three-part series and reinterpretation of The Little Mermaid, and we also discuss parallels with Free Britney. With that, let's get the tea from Malcolm. Thank you so much for joining us, Malcolm. This is very exciting for us.
No, thank you for having me.
You were one of the first authers I read when I was, young, and I felt like I was first discovering the world of nonfiction. And I have a distinct memory of trying to get tickets to see you at the New Yorker Festival, but not being able to.
No. Yeah. Now I feel bad. You were denied.
This is actually way better. So if I had known that then, I wonder if I would have been as upset. But thank you so much for joining us. I was really, really interested to listen to the beginning of your new season of Revisionist History. So I guess before that, we can just sort of talk about you as a writer. Mm-hmm. Your writing is so varied, and it has touched on so many elements of trying to explain the realities of the world that we live in. So how do you decide what topics to explore at any given time?
There's no process. There's only serendipity and good fortune and waking up in the middle of the night desperate for some new idea. I do 10 episodes of Revisionist History season, and I had 9 ideas up until 2 weeks ago, and I desperately needed a 10th. And I literally did wake up at 3 in the morning and realize, oh, that would work. And then didn't get back to sleep, of course. I just finished that episode, I think. I did the first draft. I think it did work. But I don't even know why it came to me. I wanted to do this thing on... I woke up in the morning and I just thought, I should do something about dogs.
Really? What are you going to do about dogs?
I'm doing something about, disease detection dogs. The dogs, which I didn't even know that much about, but there was some connection made, at 3 in the morning that made me think this would be really fun to do. And I then Googled some, just literally the words, dogs sniff disease. And we ended up in Alabama. 4 days later.
Wow.
And we had the best time. It's all about what would happen. The episode's all about could we have dealt with the pandemic much more efficiently if we had used dogs to detect the virus and not all these insanely expensive, cumbersome, ridiculous tests. But it just meant we got to hang out with dogs and tell great dog stories. And it was so much fun. But so how did I decide to? I mean, I don't know if I decided. I just woke up in the morning desperate for an idea. And that was what came to mind.
That's amazing. So, I mean, I'm a big dog lover. I have 2 dogs. Do you have any dogs?
I have a cat. I grew up with dogs. Although I don't believe in the dog cat. I don't believe
war,
you belong
the dog
to
cat
one.
War.
I'm not interested in that war. I belong to both parties.
I had cats growing up and now I have dogs. So, I'm with you.
Would you go back? Would you add a cat to the equation?
I don't know if our dogs would take it so well. They really like attention. But I'm not anti-cat,
yeah.
know.
No, so. They're different. It's like they're so, they occupy very different spaces in our hearts. And my, but the cat, Biggie Smalls, the cat he is, he thinks he's a dog. So it's very confusing. It's almost like I have a dog, only he's a little British short hair. He just struts around like he is a dog. Anyway, but anyway, so dogs, I love dogs. And this is great fun to do.
One of my cats growing up had that dog-like personality as well, so I understand that. But did you find that dog detection would have been an effective means during the pandemic?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the problem is we don't have enough dogs.
Oh, wow.
We would need to have hundreds of thousands of dogs to have made it work, or even tens of thousands. But dogs are so much better at detecting COVID than any man-made system of doing it. Dogs are amazing. And the whole piece turned into this whole thing about how we've had for thousands of years this best friend who is amazing at the one thing we're actually bad at. We have bad noses as human beings. We're not good smellers. Dogs are the greatest smellers ever, and we just don't use them enough. So it's all about like, why are we, you know, we'll condescend to pets and have them, you know, just around to kind of stroke and, you know, shake a paw and whatever, roll over. But we don't want to use them at the thing they're actually really good at and that they want to do, by the way.
Unless you want them to sniff for drugs. So they allow them to do that. Don't
they
forget.
They do allow that. They do allow them to do that.
Yeah, my dogs have wonderful noses. They will. One of them, in fact, sniffed out an entire dish of stuffed shells last night and devoured it. So I trust they could have found COVID. I'm definitely very interested to listen to that. But I do want to talk about your latest, I guess, triad of episodes that focuses on The Little Mermaid. It seems like you have a really interesting set of theories going. So would you want to, I guess, introduce that to the Betches Up audience?
Well, so believe it or not, I had never seen The Little Mermaid until this spring. So I'm way, way, way behind. And in fact, I don't even think I had ever seen a Disney animated movie in my entire life.
Wow.
Which seems incredible. But I grew up without a television. So all of the stuff, by the time I didn't really have a television until I was in college. And I would go down to the TV room and watch TV with everybody else. So like, I missed all this stuff. So I ran across this article written by this unbelievably brilliant a woman named Laura Beth Nielsen, who also happens to be, importantly for the purposes of podcast, hilarious, deeply hilarious. I know you've listened to the episode. You know what I'm talking about.
Yes.
So she had wrote this amazing paper about all the problems with The Little Mermaid. And I was like, that's so weird. So then I watched it. And I was like, oh, she's so right. This is like a massively problematic. So then I started calling around to people who I thought would be, might have an opinion on this. And so you've listened to the first episode, what happens in, by the third episode, we do three episodes on The Little Mermaid, I commissioned my friend Britt Marling, who did she's the screenwriter who did The OA, you know, she's like.
I love the OA.
Yes, so I thought The OA was amazing. Well, I've known Britt for years, and I called her up and I said, Britt, will you, did you ever watch The Little Mermaid as a kid? And she goes, are you kidding me? I used to tie my feet together with a tube sock and dive into our pool and pretend to be a mermaid. That's how obsessed I was with The Little Mermaid. So she agreed to rewrite The Little Mermaid. So the first two episodes are all the things that's wrong with it. And the third episode is Britt rewrites it and then and fixes it. And then we had this really fun thing. We were like, well, let's do Britt's version as a radio play. And do you want me to tell you who we cast in all the various roles?
Yeah, of course. I want to hear what happens in her rewriting of it.
Well, we gotta leave the casting to later because it's very exciting. It's very exciting who we got. Well, Britt, so, you know, we walk through all the issues. And the biggest issue that Britt has is, and it is the major issue with the movie, which is you start out and you have this mermaid who is adventurous and full of life and wants to explore the world and doesn't want to be trapped into all of the kind of stereotypical roles that Young Mermaids gets trapped into. And she has this desire to become a princess. She falls in love with the prince and she wants to become a human and have feet. And of course, she makes the deal with the evil sea witch, Ursula. And she runs into trouble, right? And then what happens? She has to be rescued by Prince Eric. Now, there's your problem number one.
Right.
So,
and with every Disney movie, kind of.
And with every Disney, by the way. A young woman full of life and adventure and intelligence and verve. And the only way out of her dilemma is for a man to come along and bail her out. Problem number one. Two, how does the man bail her out? By committing a murder in cold blood. That's also a problem. He just flat out murders Ursula. By the way, I don't know why everyone's so angry at Ursula. Like, we get into, in our revision, Brit rescues Ursula. I'll get to that.
Oh, wow.
And then there's the additional problem that the beautiful thing about the original Disney movie is this metaphor of Ariel having to give up her voice in order to find a place in the world, right? To be accepted as, which is this incredible metaphor about female adolescence.
Absolutely.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are just as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They're milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
When I heard that you were doing a series on it, I was like, oh, well, of course, it's about how a young woman has to give up her voice to be with a man. And then Meghan Markle, as you mentioned in the episode, demonstrates that exact point. But what I found interesting about the first episode was that you didn't really make that sort of obvious, you didn't make it about that obvious problem. You made it more about sort of the contractual agreements we make in society.
Yes.
And
just getting warmed up. We're just getting warmed up for that first episode.
Right.
But what I was going to say was, having created this incredibly interesting problem or engage with this incredibly interesting idea that young girls have to give up their voice, right? What does the Disney movie say at the end? It says, well, the only way for them to get their voice back is to have a man get it back for them.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
Which is nuts. It's completely nuts. What kind of message is that?
I mean, what's sort of crazy to me is that this was like one of the first movies I ever saw. Aladdin was first. And then I think The Little Mermaid. Yeah. And like, I never even thought about how that was a problem until I was maybe like 20 something. And like, why didn't my mom say anything? I feel like if I watched something like that now, I'd be like, this is pretty obviously messed up and I'm going to make that clear. Like, why didn't any of the moms say anything?
It's so weird. I don't know. I mean, is it that generation, you know, your mom belonged to it and your grandmother and your great grandmother all belonged to a generation where were they so kind of just beaten down by how much sort of sexism they had to deal with that they just couldn't be, they didn't have the energy to bring the fight to Disney movies?
Well, now that I am thinking about why my own mother didn't say anything, it's maybe like, just without getting into too many specifics of her marriage and that, kind of the metaphor actually works quite well for her. And I can see why she didn't say something. But my grandmother was not like that whatsoever. And she was the one taking me to these movies, buying me these books. Mm-hmm. And she was not, I would say, like a woman who was beaten down by sexism whatsoever. She was very independent. So I wonder about that. But even, you know, without just taking it from my individual situation, like this was societally accepted. Like everyone I knew had Disney princesses dressed up as them, had dolls, all the merch. You go to Disney Worlds and yeah, it's pretty interesting that the millennial generation in particular was raised with this so ingrained.
Yeah, with this kind of force-fed, this fantasy. And by the way, you can start, we do this in the second episode, we sort of go further with it. You know, the reason that fantasy is so destructive is not just that it sends this kind of incredibly retrograde message to young girls about where they can find their freedom and who's in control of their destiny and all those kinds of things. It's also that the world that Disney creates in these movies is a world that has of princes and princesses, and then a whole cast of characters who serve them.
Right.
Right? I mean, it's just like, and it's
the servers are like sort of these like caricatures of of other, I guess they sort of are meant to embody stereotypes of certain personalities.
Let's remember that in The Little Mermaid, one of those servants is a guy with I say this as someone who is half Jamaican, with like a Jamaican accent. Like, can we go right. even further with this? Can we, like, this is a movie that has as the subservient character a black guy from the West Indies, right?
Right.
He's like, who is it? It's Scuttle. Is it Scuttle? No. Who's the? No. Is that Scuttle?
Sebastian.
It's Sebastian. Sebastian, of course. It's Sebastian who has a bad Jamaican accent, by the way, not a good one. But like, I don't. It's just like there's all of this. It's like a 19th century thing. It's like the kind of thing you would tell your kid if it was 1860 and you were in some country house in England and that's what you were. It's just so odd to me that this is what's going on in urban homes in 21st century America.
Right. I also think if you can, like, when you look at the way that the female characters are drawn, they are drawn to embody sort of what, like, that Victorian era clothing was supposed to look like. If you look at, like, Belle, they all have these teeny tiny waists and giant poofy skirts, like, clearly created by a corset, and, like, these huge eyes. And, yeah, it is the way they're drawn is almost retro of sort of like what the male gaze idealizes the woman body to be. But also in the drawing, I'll never forget when I was like, I don't know, probably 16 or 17, and people, you start discovering that the way like the castle in The Little Mermaid is actually drawn to look like a penis, and that all these like sexual imagery is actually within Disney's illustration. And you think about, you know, that was probably created by just like a bunch of like 20, 30, 40 year old men who were like, let me like get these, like, let me try to sexualize this children's movie.
Yeah.
And yeah, I mean, if you go on like TikTok, there's definitely like a whole world of people who are like, the first Disney character, the first person I ever had a crush on was like a Disney character. And like, that's not by accident.
Yeah, no. It's not by accident. There's something really, you know, the other insidious thing is, and this is what we get into in the second of the three episodes, we get into this whole notion is there are two historic forms in which fairy tales can be told. One is called a poetic justice fairy tale, where good things happen to good people and bad things happen to bad people. And Disney, and the other way is what's called a fairy tale twist, where you don't know what's going to happen. There's some kind of chance, random thing that a surprise happens. People's fates are not predetermined by their character or their actions. And Disney movies are always the first kind. It is always the case that bad people get punished and good people are rewarded. Not just that, not just good people, that attractive,
yes,
powerful good white, people get rewarded.
Usually.
Right, usually. And that anyone who doesn't fit that stereotype. So Ursula in The Little Mermaid gets murdered. Whereas, you know, Prince Eric is rewarded with the beautiful bride. That goes on and on and on and on. And that's like really, we had this long discussion with this totally fascinating guy who was talking about how destructive that idea is to young kids, because the kids watches that movie, understands, sees this lesson, and then they think, what do they think? They're smart, and they think, oh, I'm not perfect. Does that mean bad things are going to happen to me, right? I'm not this beautiful, rich, like, am I destined to be punished because of my imperfection? And that's like nuts. Why is that a lesson we're peddling to kids at the most vulnerable moment of their development?
You know, now I think I know why I was so anxious as a child.
Like, you watched too much Disney.
I watched a lot. I would repeat on the VCR, rewind, watch again. I had the books. I had the outfits. Like,
oh, you were full on.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up as a child in the 90s. I was born in 1989. I am like that core 90s audience who hit adolescence right at 9/11, graduated, you know, was in college during the recession. Like, I am that core millennial who, like, you could probably track my views against the views of most people my age. It wasn't just Little Mermaid. In Beauty and the Beast, the Beast is like kind of an asshole, and he looks ugly because he's like, and deformed. It's like, well, what about just people who have unattractive features? Like, are you saying like the punishment? Yeah, it's completely, and you can really see that in kind of all their movies. The villains are always ugly, scary, a different color. Like,
yeah. So one of the things we wanted to do, so when I called Britton and said, I want you to rewrite it, the movie, and to rewrite the ending, really. It's really the last. The movie's great. The first half of that movie is just fantastic. First two-thirds is fantastic. It starts to fall apart when you know, Ariel has to be rescued by all of her, by Prince Eric and others. So Brit takes the, starting with, when they crash the wedding party on the boat. So she starts there. And one of the things she does is she tries to, one, give Ariel some sense of agency back, but also she has to rescue Ursula because Britt wanted to break out of this idea that Ursula has to be punished because she's ugly and old and troubled. I mean, Ursula's troubled, right?
Right.
She was exiled from the kingdom. Like, so in the Disney movie, we take the troubled, unhappy exile and we murder them. We ram them with the prow of our ship, right?
Very violent also. All these movies. Very violent.
Crazy
violent. Talk it out, guys.
So in our version, that doesn't, I'm not going to give it away, but Ursula gets redeemed. Ursula gets, instead of murdering Ursula, Ariel confronts her. Not confronts, it's the wrong word. Ariel has a conversation with her. And they find a way to kind of reconcile their differences. It's so...
How does she do that without the voice?
How does she do that without... Oh, she gets... Wait, now I'm forgetting our mechanism for her getting her voice back. We have it...
You don't have to give it away.
I'm not going to give it away.
Make people listen.
I'm not gonna give it away. Yeah. No, she, in the, as it works out, she has this conversation, this incredibly moving conversation with Ursula at the climax of our version. And, you know, can I boast about our casting?
Absolutely. I was about to ask. So, yes.
Our Ursula is Glenn Close.
Oh, wow. Famous,
our Ariel,
famously Cruella.
Exactly. And our Ariel is Jodie Foster.
Oh, wow. I'm excited to hear that.
And our Prince Eric is Dax Shepard.
Real, of course. So, podcasting superstar.
Superstar. And he plays Prince Eric as a doofus, as like a, just a dumb kind of airhead.
Like a high school
kid.
Yeah. Yeah.
But when you hear, the reason I bring up, so we gave these two incredibly gifted actresses a chance to rethink these two seminal roles, Ariel and Ursula, right? The two of the most, in the imaginations of young children in America, two of the most important characters, right? Vivid. And we said to these two insanely talented actresses, rethink, here's a new script in which doesn't have the same cartoonish, ridiculous ending. Breathe new life into these characters. And it, when we were doing the Glenn Close parts in particular, although both, but Glenn Close does a revision of Ursula, and suddenly Ursula's not a one-dimensional villain. She's a woman who has been struggling under a burden as this kind of exile and wants to be rescued and brought back into the fold. And she gave Ursula back her humanity, as only an incredible actor can do, right?
Yeah.
And I always loved Glenn Close, but when I'd never seen her, when she was reading that part for our little, it was just like, it was so fantastic. It was like, my jaw was on the floor. I was like, I cannot believe how, first of all, how suddenly I had this, she makes me have sympathy for Ursula. I felt for Ursula as I watched Glenn Close kind of revisit that character and bring her to life. But also I was like, Glenn Close, damn, this woman can't act. I mean, if I was asked to be an actor in the same movie or play as Glenn Close, I would say no, because I feel like she would just blow me out of the water.
Or she would level you up. You never
or
know.
She would I don't know. I mean, I'm not an actor. I have no idea what that's like. But you can. I mean, if you're sharing any kind of stage with her, she's gonna, you know, outshine you by so many watts. Anyway, it was like so much fun to do this kind of recreation of an iconic movie.
That's amazing. Would you ever consider doing this with other movies? Mm. I mean, I wonder if like this could. I mean, Disney, I'm not going to speak for Disney, but I do feel that it could be such an opportunity for a company like Disney to move their storytelling forward in a way that aligns with the newer generations, like the new zeitgeist, in a way that makes more sense for kids.
Yeah, I actually couldn't agree with you more. So there's a couple things you said. Do we want to do more of these? Absolutely. It was so much fun to do. Everyone... you know, Jodie Foster came up to our studio in Hudson to record her parts, and it was so much fun. She stuck around all afternoon. There was this opportunity to do something different and new, and I totally want to do that again.
Well, if you need someone to rewrite the ending of Sleeping Beauty, I will happily contribute.
But the Disney thing's super interesting. So I really want, and I don't know the answer to this. I tried to interview the guy who wrote The Little Mermaid, who's a big Disney director, who also, I've forgotten, he did a bunch of the other big ones. I've forgotten them right now. And I tried and tried and tried and tried, didn't get anywhere. I really don't know whether Disney is aware of all of the problems with these movies, or whether they just think, you know, F it. This is making us billions of dollars. We're not going to mess with it. And maybe what America needs is, you know, these kinds of incredibly, what's the right word for these stories?
Retro.
Yes, retro is not a bad word.
Stories. It's a kind word for.
It's a kind word. But I don't know if we sat down here with, you know, Bob Iger, the head of the CEO of chairman of the Disney company, I honestly don't know. Would he say, you know, maybe you're right, or would he get really defensive? I don't know the answer to that question. What do you think?
I think it depends who his PR team is and what they tell him he should say. Because he's not, whether Bob Iger agrees with this sort of philosophy or not, is almost irrelevant, since he is leading a public company and whatever he says has to align with whatever strategy they're taking. And I'm sure their strategy is based on millions of dollars in market research. And who knows what it would involve for them to unearth this.
But, at the same time, all of those big Disney executives, not all of them, but many of them have children.
Right.
Many of them have daughters. And I am sure that they all sat down, because it's their own company, sat down with their daughters and watched these movies at some point. It must have occurred to them, like, even if it was unstated, that, wait a second, what exactly am I teaching my daughter here? Right. I mean, do I really? I mean, so they must, in their heart of hearts, have at least some reservations about what they're peddling, right? I can't imagine that they don't.
Well, maybe they like it, because in that structure, because ultimately the structure of what they're teaching patriarchal ideals, and maybe they're like, you know, maybe it's not great for my daughter, but I got to stay up here. And who I don't, maybe they don't necessarily want this sort of ideological undermining. And they realize that Disney plays that role and has the power to actually tonally change the way people look at things. Mm-hmm. But I wonder, what effect do you think that this has on, like, young boys who are watching these films?
So here's where I have to, because all of these Disney films were absent from my childhood. I don't know. Do you have brothers?
I had a brother who passed away, but he had autism. I will say he loved Disney movies, but he had autism. So it wasn't the same sort of connection with it, but he really enjoyed watching Disney movies. Yeah. So yeah, it's hard for me to say.
Yeah, I don't know to what extent. I don't know how. I guess the better way to say this, I don't know how a young boy watches these movies. So does the way a 7-year-old boy watched The Little Mermaid differ from the way a 7-year-old girl does? Do they, because they're on the winning side, you know, they're not identifying with Ariel, they're identifying with Prince Eric, who's like jumping on the boat and saving the beautiful woman. So maybe their way of processing it is very different. But I don't know if it's any less problematic, because, you know, we've been talking about the way the female characters in this movie are portrayed. The way Prince Eric is portrayed, and King Triton, but particularly Prince Eric, is in some ways worse.
Right.
Because his only function in this movie, first of all, he's an idiot. He doesn't...
he doesn't recognize the bait and switch.
Doesn't recognize the bait and switch. And two, the only thing the movie allows him to do is to murder Ursula. He's not allowed to solve the problem in any creative way. He's just required to jump on his boat and ram her with the prow of his ship. That's his function in the movie, is to like I said, to murder her. Like, that's fucked. I'm sorry, can I say that?
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Oh yeah.
More
fucked
than
up. So it's just as bad. So I don't know, if I'm a 7-year-old boy and I sit and watch that, am I cheering for that, or am I like saying, well, wait a minute, why is this guy acting like such a doofus?
Well, I think probably, and now that I'm thinking, like, just more broadly about what Disney movies and how they portray their male protagonists, they're usually the men are not the main character. Is one thing that I think is interesting. The female tends to be the main character, but the male still tends to be the stronger character. And then what they typically demonstrate is strength through violence. When you think about it, I think every Disney movie involves physicality. It's, none of it is like outsmarting with, you know, I think Home Alone sort of does a better job of teaching like a young male how to get by than some of these Disney movies. Cause there's a lot of sword fighting and slaying of dragons and that sort of thing. And I wonder if that, I mean, if I'm a young boy, I guess the message I'm probably taking is my physicality is the most important, and the ability to physically dominate someone is how I'm going to impress women. Yeah. And then that carries through video games. And I'm not someone who wants to demonize video games, but it does. Action movies. And yeah, it's sort of like just one link in the chain. Yeah.
It's what I would be really curious. I don't know the answer to this, but when you, it's just what you just said makes me wonder, is a lot of the appeal of those later adult versions, those of the adult comic, the adult animated movie is, you know, Die Hard or whatever the, right. you know, same. But did we prime the pump with these Disney things? In other words, is the reason we are as, why young men are as obsessed with these kind of violent fantasies because we planted the seed when they were six with these kind of antiquated fairy tales? And if so, that's even more fucked up.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the older I get, not that I'm so old, I observe people around me and I read more about sort of psychology of how people's attachments are formed and how their beliefs are formed. I do think that a lot of it forms earlier than we realize. And if you look at sort of like how, as an adult, how someone can navigate like their family, what they think is normal is what they grew up mm-hmm. with in their family. So, I mean, I can't imagine that the images that we watched in our spare time for hours a week could have done anything less than subliminally. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like I can remember certain lines from certain Disney movies, like, so well because they were implanted so young and I watched them so repeatedly. And I think about sort of the beliefs or the inherent sort of automatic assumptions I made about the world until I was maybe like 25. And they definitely, it took, I would say, the Me Too movement, the things that happened from 2016 and past, for me to sort of like mentally flip from mm-hmm. some of these like mm-hmm. patriarchal assumptions that mm-hmm. I realized were so ingrained in me. And so I can't imagine that there's anything more that would affect you than what you see when you're very young.
Yeah. Well, this was, you know, in the episode that you listened to, the first episode, this was Laura Beth Nielsen's point. So she, as you know, she's fixated on the fact that Ursula makes Ariel sign this contract, the contract that she will give up her voice in return for getting legs and being a human being. And the contract, Ursula says, once Ariel signs it, the contract can't be broken, right? That's why they have to murder Ursula. And Laura Beth Nielsen, who is both a sociologist and a law professor, she makes this very simple point, which is there's no such thing as a contract that can't be broken. The whole point of the law is the law doesn't think that once you've signed your name to something, it's over. The law gives you multiple opportunities for revisiting those kinds of things, particularly if the contract that you signed is unconscionable, is some kind of like, and so the contract that Ariel signs with Ursula is exactly the kind of contract that would not hold up in a court of law. It involves a minor, it involves a sale of body parts. It's like, so, and she's kind of tongue-in-cheek on this, but she's kind of not, because she's saying, look, six-year-olds and seven-year-olds are forming their notions of what the law is at that age. And Disney is teaching them that the law is this kind of stupid, blind, crazy mechanism by which people are exploited. She's like, that's not what the law is, right? The law, here's a woman, a brilliant woman who's devoted her life to being a law professor, among other things. And her whole thing is, why is she a lawyer? Because of the opposite, because she sees the law as a way of bringing justice to the world, right? So she's like, she's watching this movie with her kids, and she's like, wait a second. The notion of law that's enshrined in this Disney movie is the exact opposite of the way law ought to function in real life. Why the Walt Disney Company, are you telling my kids a lie about what the law is?
Well, I think Disney probably benefits from people thinking that you can't break contracts with them.
Exactly. Yes, they do.
Yeah.
They might have a little bit of a conflict of interest on this one.
That's the other subliminal message. Like, you have phallic symbols and legal yes. advice.
Don't mess with our team of our army of attorneys.
We all dread the what should we have for dinner question. I know I do. I love a home-cooked meal, but I don't always have the time, energy, or groceries to make it happen. Being able to feast on a delicious meal without the long prep and cook times is what drew me to Home Chef over the other guys. Home Chef's meals are effortless, so I can spend less time trying to be top chef and more time watching it. Whether you prefer classic meal kits with pre-portioned ingredients and easy instructions, speedy recipes ready in less than 30 minutes, oven-ready kits with pre-chopped ingredients, or quick microwave meals that assemble in minutes, Home Chef has you covered for delicious meals without the hassle. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. Home Chef has over 30 options a week and serves a variety of dietary needs, so you never have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. For a limited time, Home Chef is offering our listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life, and of course, free shipping on your first box. Go to homechef.com/feverdream. That's homechef.com/feverdream for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard that right. homechef.com/feverdream. Must be an active subscriber to receive free dessert.
That was such an interesting point. It was, I will admit, completely novel and out of left field when I heard her saying that, because it never even occurred to me that a contract was like a main feature of that movie. But obviously she had, you know, her whole theory, and especially that would make Prince Eric's killing an extrajudicial killing, which is exactly. Obviously something we have a problem with as well. Listening to it when I did, while we're sort of in the midst of Free Britney and Bill Cosby getting out of prison yesterday, I thought that it was such an interesting sort of like intersection of that. And do you think that there's sort of like any echoes of that within what we're watching play out now?
Oh, particularly with Free Britney. Free Britney, I just say on the subject of Free Britney, this is a classic example of a story that isn't nearly big enough. You know, this should be... This isn't just an entertainment story or a weird story involving. This is actually a really, really fundamental example of how the law is not being exercised justly. It's an outrage. What she's gone through is absolutely outrageous, and it's not specific to her. There are a specific set of laws around guardianship that are badly written and being abused routinely. And this should be, if we do it right, you know, Britney should be the kind of way and the means by which we revisit and rewrite these set of ridiculous rules. But like the idea that like a intelligent, successful adult is somehow treated like she's a slave.
She had a song to that. She had a song with that title. So,
yeah,
you know. Yeah. It's actually kind of prescient how many of her song lyrics do echo what she's going through now. But so what do you think should change other than they should just letting her out? Like, what do you think should be changed in a bigger sense?
Well, I don't, I'm not a lawyer and don't know the specifics of the guardianship thing. But the crucial point to your original question is that the reason that this issue has gone on for as long as it has with Britney and other people is that we are oddly sometimes, complacent's not the right word, we forget that the law is supposed to embody justice. And we kind of give up on trying to fix these kind of fundamental moral errors that get baked into certain kinds of laws. And that little, as trivial as it seems, that moment in The Little Mermaid where everyone just, Ursula says it's an unbreakable contract, and everyone else just says, okay, I guess we can't break it then, that's the same impulse. It's like, oh, she's being controlled by her dad. Oh, and oh, I guess we got to, deal with that somehow. Like, it's the same thing. It's this kind of fatalism. And by the way, I'm reaching into a much more grandiose thing. What was the civil rights movement about in the 1960s? It was a series of people, Martin Luther King and others, confronting this very same notion the law in America ought to be something that does not reinforce historical patterns of discrimination, but rather can be used to liberate a disadvantaged minority. It was all about the law, right? It was about when they were in Birmingham marching every day, they weren't doing that to show off or whatever. They were doing that to change the laws around segregation in the South, to get the Civil Rights Act passed in 1964. We'll go on and on and on. Like that, all of these movements, the ones that really are powerful and have at their core this notion of this positive notion about what the law can do.
Right.
And Disney's telling us something else.
Do you ever feel like the people who are most or least afraid to bend a contract, break the law, are the ones who tend to do it for ill-gotten gains or wrong, you know, selfish reasons? Because I feel like the only people who care about the law are like the people who want good, like justice. Like, I don't know. I think especially now there's this like manipulation of legality for convenience that you just see all the time, and it feels so hard to fight back against.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's interesting. I mean, I think it maybe it depends on the realm. You know, when I think of, when I read stories about how like billionaires are not paying taxes.
Right.
And they are adhering to the letter of the law, but not its spirit.
Right.
And I think that little part bothers me. Like, you have an obligation if you're wealthy, I think, to attend to the spirit of the laws in the country that you're a part. Yes, your accountant can come up with some incredibly clever thing so you pay zero taxes, but it doesn't mean you should do it.
Right. Right?
You. So I do think there has to be, the law's not this kind of, it's not this, it's more, it's a living document that has a spirit to it, and you have to attend to the spirit of it. And that's what I find missing, is people take this very, very narrow scope of what the law is about and don't sit that back and reflect about, well, why do we have this law in the first place? What's it intending to accomplish? In the case of taxes, the law, the tax laws are there to ensure that all of us pay a fair share, and these guys are not paying a fair share, right? So I guess in that instance, yeah, there's some game playing going on with legality.
Yeah, I think you see it a lot. Like, even, you know, we had the Me Too movement, but in terms of consequences, legal consequences or financial ones, it doesn't really feel like there were so many. It feels like it was an ideological victory, but a lot of it also just feels like women who have suffered from things, or not necessarily only women, people who have suffered from the dynamics as they exist in society today, sort of screaming into this Twitter void where they have a lot of power to knock someone off their like social media apparatus pedestal, but that's only their like social media. That's not, or, you know, it doesn't necessarily do anything long term because the law doesn't have the teeth. Or the lawyers are just too good and expensive on, yeah, it is quite disappointing. But it seems like the Little Mermaid led the way.
The Little Mermaid was in the vanguard of this. Yes, it was.
So, Malcolm, thank you so much for this conversation. I am so excited to hear these next two episodes and to hear these wonderful, talented actors who are going to be replaying this new story. And I just have to say thank you. Is there anything else you would like to share with our audience? I understand you have a new book out as well.
Called The Bomber Mafia. Yes, it's the audiobook is something that we're very proud of because we're taking the kind of narrative and audio qualities of podcasts and turning them into audiobooks. And so, yeah, that was something that just came out a couple months back. But no, this has been really, really fun. I've really enjoyed it. And I hope you enjoy parts two and three as much as you enjoy part one.
Thank you. And I do just want to say, I as you're describing, I mean, first the way you handled The Bomber Mafia as an audiobook and now this three-part series of The Little Mermaid, I could see this really becoming a a trend within podcasting. So
I hope so.
Yeah, you're definitely inspiring me.
And I'm which way? What's the one you wanted to rewrite? Beauty and the Beast?
Sleeping Beauty.
Sleeping Beauty. All right, right. We'll be back. We'll be back to get your thoughts.
Okay. Thank you. Like, yeah, I mean, I'm not a screenwriter, but I can think of some ideas. Right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Afternoon Tea is produced by Sean Kilby and Jorge Morales Pico. Our editor is Stacey Wong. Social media by Amanda Duberman. Guest booking by Nicole Pellegrino. Be sure to follow @Betches_sup on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And send us your emails to suppod@betches.com. Betches.